Shabbatean tradition that issued from Jacob Frank. Because the key myth of Scottish Rite Freemasonry was that when the Templars were in the Holy Land, they came into contact with a number of Eastern, they rescued them supposedly and brought them back to Scotland. And this is how you get the birth of the Scottish Rite occult tradition. And who these...
I think you need to explain that more fully. Freemasonry existed before this happened. How did Scottish Rite Freemasonry emerge out of that tradition? Or is that a mythology?
Out of which tradition?
The tradition of Freemasonry, and how did the idea of rebuilding Solomon's Temple, which is the ultimate goal of Freemasonry, right, enter into it? Enter into Freemasonic mythology.
Well, it's the thing is this idea of the Templar association with Eastern mystics really began to take root at the beginning of the 18th century in German Templarism, and I'll get back to my point about Jacob Frank because it's directly related. Who these mystics were the assassins, the Ismaili assassins,
Hashish.
The Hashishim, exactly, who derived, basically, originally they derived from Egypt, right? Because supposedly this ancient Gnostic tradition of Alexandria, which was falsely identified with Hermeticism, had supposedly survived through the centuries and was being held in secret by the by groups like the Ismailis, who had established an empire, a small empire based out of Egypt at the time, who also controlled Palestine at the time, up until the time of the Crusades. So the Ismailis were supposedly the preservers of this ancient Gnostic tradition that was originally derived from the Essenes. So the Templars were supposedly to have learned this. So now when Napoleon conquers Egypt, Masons and his army set out to reconnect with the same lost people, the Ismailis, who had preserved this Gnostic tradition, to revive this age-old connection between the Templars and the Assassins by reconnecting with their lost brothers, essentially.
Is this related at all to Sufism? The Sufism?
Very indirectly. No, it's more specifically, it has to do specifically with Ismailism. And so this is how you get the birth of Egyptian Freemasonry, both in Egypt and in Europe. Well, just prior to that, I guess Cagliostro was the inventor of Egyptian Freemasonry. But Egyptian Freemasonry now becomes fully aligned with a group called the Asiatic Brethren. The Asiatic Brethren were founded by Moses Dobruska, who was the cousin and
Jacob Frank.
Of Jacob Frank.
And he instigated the French Revolution.
That's right. Throughout the 18th century, there was a collusion between the English Rosicrucians and the Asiatic Brethren were the key to most of the political and revolutionary movements of the period. And what happens is at the end of the 19th century, most of the leading occultists affiliated with this network of three secret societies traveled to Egypt. And they travel there to go study under a guy named Jamaluddin al-Afghani. And this guy is an imposter. He's posing as a Shia. He calls himself Afghani, claiming he comes from Afghanistan, but he really comes from Iran. And he's likely an Ismaili. He travels regularly to Europe, but before he goes to Europe, he goes to India. He travels there with Helena Blavatsky. I hope you're familiar with her.
Theosophical. Theosophist.
Yes. The godmother of the New Age movement. Her two tomes have been referred to as the Bibles of Freemasonry.
The Secret Doctrine.
Right. The Secret Doctrine and Isis Unveiled. He travels with her to India, and on his stay there, he also stops by to go visit with the Aga Khan, who's the then head of the Ismailis. He's also preaching for the Baha'i faith in the meantime. And he comes back, and then he's involved. He's basically the Grand Master of the Freemasons in Egypt.
Somebody like that has money behind him.
Presumably, that's a good point.
And very good connections.
I mean, the leading occultists of the period, they all flocked to Egypt. So starting with Blavatsky, but also John Yarker, Karl Kellner, Theodore Royce. all these guys, and they come back.
Are you familiar with Arminius Vambery?
No.
He was a Rothschild agent who tried to create revolutionary ideas and pan-Turkic and pan-Turian ideas,
right,
so that the Rothschilds could capture the oil of Baku, which
right,
ultimately led to the Armenian genocide. So, as you say, there was a lot of this going on among
right,
Freemasons and among missionaries, English
right,
and American missionaries in formerly or still Muslim territory.
You know, what's interesting is Afghani was also involved in the Young Turk movement.
I wasn't aware of that. And another aside I would like to bring up is that you had the French Revolution leading as if inevitably to the rise of Napoleon. You had Napoleon, who viewed himself as the Messiah of the Jews who would restore them to Palestine, and you have Napoleon emancipating the Jews across Europe and trying to take Palestine as a homeland for them. And at this time, there were only about 500 to 5,000 Jews in Paris. And it is amazing that they wielded this type of influence. And you had the Jewish bankers funding both sides of the battles that Napoleon fought. And
right,
you ultimately had Russian Jews bringing about the downfall of Napoleon, because by emancipating the Jews, he was leading them into apostasy.
Right. Yeah, all interconnected.
All interconnected, and very much what happened in the Roman Empire. And you also had the death in France of religion and the attempted destruction of Catholicism and the rise of a sun god as the emperor.
That's right. Yeah, it's the push towards secularism was the key. The first great. This is why, you know, throughout these thousands of years, you know, going back to the other point, is that they exercise varying degrees of influence, but it's really only in the last 200 years that their influence has been to this extent, you know, fully pervasive. But I don't think they've ever been able to exercise a degree of power. They've been able to exercise influence, but now they can exercise power. And now that has to do, going back to the two revolutions, which were the great coup d'etats that through which they managed to seize power. And the key to that, of course, was the Enlightenment and promoting this idea of reason, which is man resorting to his own wits as opposed to revelation.
Now, you see the French Revolution and the American Revolution as products of the Enlightenment.
Absolutely.
And you see the American Constitution as a secular document, which is the ultimate fruit of the Enlightenment and of the Kabbalah.
I think the American Constitution, if I can say so, is one of the great blasphemies of all time. It's essentially a human-made revelation. It's designed to replace the Bible and to provide what are called inalienable rights, so some kind of absolute truth that humans can live by, as opposed to divine revelation. And it's the first step. It's the key. They had, you know, they used this excuse about religious persecution to separate the church and state, but really it was separating the church from their affairs.
And this
is a process that goes back all the way back to Cromwell, when the banking powers, primarily in Europe, not yet in England, of course, but this is what they are working to change, were starting to exercise increasing influence. A great book on the subject is called Religion and the Rise of Capitalism by Taney. And he details the whole process of this evolution, of the war of interest banking against Christianity, and how the church eventually lost out to the influence of the bankers. And the slow process through which the legality of interest banking was slowly accommodated. And this is largely, so when you look back at guys like Adam Smith, this is essentially what they're arguing for. They're arguing for the state out of their affairs. That, you know, the most inhibiting factor was the fact that, you know, interest is forbidden in every religion, in Christianity, including Buddhism, and of course Buddhism, including Islam.
That's a very important point. I think there's another important point, is they wanted to separate the power of the clerical and the profane, the secular and the clerical, whereas the church, especially under the Holy Roman Empire, had maintained both civil and religious power. They wanted to separate those two and then destroy both.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the church held any kind of sway, there was many policies that they weren't able to implement, but the most important of which was interest banking.
And
so
the other
get rid of the church. And it's still the same thing today. They're still arguing for free enterprise, but free enterprise means free reign for them.
They also wanted to destroy...
Pardon?
They also wanted to destroy the monarchies and the empires, which was the purpose of the First World War.
Yes, I suppose. I think the ultimate purpose of the First World War was to
take Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. Yes,
exactly. Because the Illuminati are the aristocracy. I mean, you know, you look at these families, and they've been intermarrying all the way back to that network of Herod and Antiochus and Caligula.
But you have even in the Old Testament the prophecies that the Messiah will destroy all the kings and princes and eliminate and make a footstool over all of the world power, and that has to include both clerical and civil power, which means the destruction of all monarchies.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I mean, the thing is, when people look for the Illuminati, they look for the bankers, but the real Illuminati is the aristocracy of Europe. And you know, if you look at cases when they kill some of them, like Louis XVI or the Tsar of Russia. It's probably just a rite of the killing of the king, and the killing of the king is an ancient occult rite. It's basically at the core of the dying god cult.
And you find that in Oliver Cromwell. And
that's right, Charles II or Charles I, exactly. You know, an important thing that happened as a result of the Cromwell Revolution was that the Jews were finally allowed back into England.
And you find that in the Russian Revolution, and there were occult rituals practiced and witnessed and photographed, Kabbalistic rituals involved with the assassination of the Tsar.
Ah, there you go. So it's the killing of the king, because otherwise the king is a member of that bloodline. The Russians, I mean, most of the aristocracies of Europe are part of the same bloodline, intermarrying extensively for centuries.
Yes, well, you had in the First World War, you had the Emperor of Germany and the Emperor of Russia being related by blood.
Right.
And you had them all related to the aristocracy of England.
Absolutely.
And you have the aristocracy of England allegedly practicing circumcision and other Jewish rites.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Queen is supposedly the leading, physical representation of the great bloodline, the great Davidic bloodline.
But I would take exception to your statement that the Illuminati consisted of the royalty. I think they were also had infiltrated by design academia with Goethe and others.
Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, they're not exclusively aristocracy, but I think there's a difference between bloodline and sort of, you know, troops. And I think, you know, the queen, her importance is basically that she's a vessel. She's a vessel of blood, and that's all her purpose is. She doesn't have to have brains. She doesn't have to rule. She doesn't have to do anything, you know, to serve society. It just survive, you know.
And but the monarchies of Europe.
That's her occult significance, and that explains why she's revered as she is, because otherwise it makes no logical sense.
Well, there was also the utility of the monarchy to spread monotheism through colonialism, which paved the way for Jewish Noahide laws, and also to instigate wars against one another by design, which would ruin the economies and throw people into debt to the Jewish bankers.
Yeah, that could be that too.
And that is what really tore apart Europe throughout the 19th century and the 20th century, were these manufactured wars to bring about... exactly what you're calling the end of history and what others have called the end of history. How do you envision the ultimate aims of the Kabbalists? What kind of world will we experience if they're successful?
Fascist global state. Plato's Republic.
Well, that has meaning to you, but it may not have meaning to everyone. I think you have to delve into the depth of depravity and why they are trying to kill religion and trying to kill culture and trying to kill the human family and trying to create sexual deviance and all the other things. What can you give any kind of graphic representation? Will it be like Bolshevist Russia? Will it be like Nazi Germany? Or will it be something even worse?
I don't know, but you know, in Islam it says that the that there has been warnings about the Dajjal throughout, and
Al-Dajjal is the Antichrist, the Muslim equivalent of Antichrist. Yes.
Yeah, I forget where I'm talking. And so, you know, prophets have warned, and Prophet Muhammad warned repeatedly about the coming of the Antichrist as well, too, because it's to be just this horrible period, you know, probably the worst period in history, and difficult. You know, I think most Muslims pray every day, five times a day. You finish their prayer with a request for protection from the Antichrist, because it's considered that, you know, I think really ultimately the Antichrist is humanity's lesson for what they allowed to happen to themselves. You know, I think that the human race just will not understand the importance of abiding by revelation until they feel the full brunt of neglecting it. And that's essentially what the conspiracy works by, enticing us to neglect or ignore revelation, to abide by God's law. And so by doing so, we are giving in to our enslavement without realizing what's happening, that we are being deliberately deceived. And the point is going to be, you know, full blown world global enslavement, I suppose. I don't know what it's going to be like, but I can see that that's at least what's being envisioned. And it's not until that point, until people are, you know, kind of like the dog pushing the corner, that they're going to recognize what was the ramifications of their neglect.
Well, let me give some of the things that I believe will happen and the reason why I believe they'll happen. There is a prophecy in the Old Testament that people will take hold of the skirt of him who is a Jew. So there will be a subservience to Jewry.
Yeah.
There will be the enforcement of the Noahide laws, which describe Mohammedism and Christianity as idol worship. And anyone who pursues those religions must be beheaded. So there will be the mass murder of everyone who does not abide by and agree to be a Noahide, as the Druze of Israel have agreed to do.
Yeah.
And there will be ultimately the exclusion of all non-Jews from Greater Israel, which is a region which extends from the Nile River
into Arabia. That's right.
And there will also be a period of terrible wars by design. I suspect nuclear wars, and we have Barack Obama and John McCain pledging that if they don't get their way in Iran, they're going to instigate a nuclear attack on Iran.
Right.
And we have the electronic means now to monitor everyone and to analyze DNA, and I suspect that there will be breeding programs to destroy anyone who is courageous, anyone who is intelligent, but is not Jewish.
Okay.
And we see that in what they do, because whenever they instigate the revolutions, one of the first things that they do is mass murder the intelligentsia.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a key component of the Russian Revolution. That was a key component of the Ottoman Revolution, the Young Turk Revolution, which was run by, as you say, crypto-Jews.
That's right.
And I suspect that that's what we can expect. And they have a tremendous capacity now through television and other means to control the public mind, and that they will turn the public mind against all tradition. And they have created, as you say, through the worship of the Greeks, an acceptance of this horror.
Right.
Now, you view that as the acceptance of secularism, and I would disagree with that, because I'm not a religious person.
As the acceptance of what? Do you cut out for a second?
The acceptance of secularism.
Right. Yeah, but I think I would agree with everything you said, and I would add to that the Antichrist is going to be worshipped as a god.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's the whole point. That's the end point of Lurianic Kabbalah. That's the point of history. That's the point of Hegel's evolution of humanity, is that in the end, eventually, man's intellectual progress will produce a man who will know that he is God.
That's the key, is that this man will be God. It's not that we will worship him as God. It's that we will acknowledge that he is God, which is what Lucifer always wanted, was to be acknowledged as God.
Right. And that's why this is the ultimate crux of this Kabbalistic history. That's the whole point.
Now, what is...
To prepare the global worship of this declared God.
What is the mechanical process? Just as the Jews were forced to abandon the idea that God would restore them to Palestine, so they had to view themselves as a people, as the Messiah, because God would not do it for them. How are these Kabbalistic Jewish bankers going to bring this about, in your opinion? And what do the Mohammedan prophecies, I know there are many prophecies that some even say that Nostradamus plagiarized his prophecies from Muhammad.
Right.
And what is it that Mohammedism prophecies as the end times?
That the Antichrist will be established for a time, that it will be a terrible time, that he will be followed by the Jews, he'll be established in Israel, and then Jesus will return, and but there will also be a Mahdi, which is a kind of a reformer leader who will lead the Muslims, and there will be a war, and Jesus will eventually kill the Antichrist.
Now, is Jesus then the Messiah, because he was not the Messiah initially, or is Jesus like John the Baptist, one who prepares the way for the Messiah?
Well, in Islam, Jesus is called the Messiah, but I don't think it has the same meaning as is understood in Christianity or Judaism, because Muhammad is the last prophet, and he's sort of the Messiah that's prophesied. But Muhammad is the Messiah that the Jews were expecting, and Jesus basically foretold of his coming as well. But he's not referred to as the Messiah. Jesus is referred to the Messiah. So I think it has a different meaning than what's understood in Christianity or Judaism.
Will Jesus be a king who rules a kingdom for 1,000 years and makes the world peaceful and beautiful?
I think there's supposed to be a 1,000-year reign. What happens is that there will be an Islamic leader, and Jesus will acknowledge him as the leader. And then there's a 1,000-year reign, and I can't remember if my details are fuzzy after that.
In Islam, the priesthood died with the Levitical priests and the destruction of the temple. Is that correct? Imams are not priests or rabbis in the sense of Catholicism or Judaism, modern Judaism.
Well, that's what it's supposed to be. But since colonialism, they've become a priesthood, and that's the function they serve. And you can tell because they dress in priest clothes, which are different than everybody else, which is not what the original intent was. In Islam, it's supposed to have scholars who are experts in religion, and that could be people who achieve that by whatever method. It's just people you trust, you understand that they're knowledgeable, and that they're pious, which is important as well, too. You can't just assess somebody by how much knowledge they have. You have to determine if they live by what they preach. And that's the way it was originally supposed to be. So originally there was no clergy in Islam, but now there is.
I see.
Saudi Arabia is a prime example of a state-sponsored clergy that's there to stamp whatever, so-called fatwas that are requested.
Something that struck me that's very interesting is traditionally Zionists have subverted Christianity, and Christianity has always, more than the Jewish people themselves, been the sponsor of Zionism. But you don't find that in Islam. They were never able to subvert Islam to make Muslims Zionists. Even when they had the Sultan of Turkey under their threat through economic means, they were about to bankrupt him, and they had disparaged him in the international press as the Red Sultan, the Bloody Sultan, the sick man of Europe.
Yeah.
Even then, they were not able to make Muslims Zionists, and especially not Arab Muslims.
No.
And we find... We find them using that today, as they did in the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, as a means of pitting Christians and Muslims against one another for the benefit of the Zionists.
Yeah.
So the Muslims do not view what is happening today in Israel as the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, as do the Christian Zionists. Is that correct? But they view it in a, well, they view it as a fulfillment of prophecy, but not in a positive way, as something that it is the Muslim's duty to resist.
Well, you mean the only reason it's viewed in a positive light is the influence, as you say, of Christian Zionism. So otherwise, I don't think, you know, the general Christian population would be viewing it as a positive outcome.
Do you have any opinions as to why they were able to subvert Christianity in this way, but not able to subvert Islam? I assume you would assume a religious posture and say because Islam is the true faith and could not be corrupted in that way.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. It's because you know, understanding the Jewish people is key, obviously, and you know, despite all the claims to the contrary, Islam is in the Quran is able to point to the excesses of the Jewish people without inciting anti-Semitism, and that's key. And that's why.
Can you give an example of that? Can you give an example of that?
Well, if you all you have to do is read the first 100 verses of the Quran, and it begins pretty much as an exposition of the Jewish people, and it treats the Jewish people as being originally God's chosen people, that God chose these people to as the first that He was going to reveal His message on a grander scale, as begin His mission essentially, but that they went against it, and that they rebelled. But it doesn't really incite hatred, because it just incites understanding. And I think that this is what has allowed, you know, Jewish societies to flourish for 1,200 years within Islamic empires, because despite knowing the deviousness that segments of the Jewish population could resort to, their presence was not only tolerated, but invited, right? Because yes. I think being aware of it allowed them, and I think the regulations of the Islamic State permitted that could be controlled. And that's what creates a very, very different attitude towards the Jews than what happened in Christianity. Because I think in Christianity, it's not defined, and the role between Jews and Christians is not defined, whereas it's very clearly defined in Islam. And in Islam, the Jews are allowed to societies within Islamic society. They're allowed to adhere to their own laws. They're allowed to have their own, essentially, sub-governments within the Islamic State.
And their prophets are viewed as prophets of God.
They're looked at as cousins, right? They're looked at as the people who first received the revelation, but who didn't accept the later prophets. But still, we share the original tenets.
When you say cousins, you mean, well, for some peoples, literally cousins of Ishmael and
genetically and theologically, yes,
the sons of Abraham.
But I don't think the genetic component really matters much, because you got to let that go anyway. Once you accept God as the one true God, then race is a non-issue.
Do Muslims view the fall of Adam and the fall of the Jews as the chosen people as an allegorical similarity?
I've never really mentioned it. I don't think it's really that key. It's mostly, I think the lesson really ultimately, especially the way I see it, is that the people are serving as an example for humanity of what happens when God blesses a people. Because when we're going to stand before Him on the Day of Judgment, some of us are going to say, well, you know, if you had just shown us the way, you know, we would have done good. We would have, you know, we wouldn't have become this wretched mess. And He'll just point to the Jewish people and He'll say, there's my example. There's a people that I have blessed not only with my revelations, but with miracles, untold miracles that no other people have witnessed, and in all kinds of other blessings. And look at what has happened. And I think that that's ultimately the lesson. When we look at them and you see what they are doing today, you're looking at the first Muslims. You're looking at the first people who receive that message from God, which is the message of how do you live your life, that very pure message of being good, if everybody followed it, we'd be living in which is the idea of what the revelation is supposed to be about. But instead, we have the opposite. We have a people who just did not have the patience to retain the humility that was necessary, that would otherwise, because God says in the Bible that if you follow these rules, I will make you rulers of the world. Right? I'll give you the earth. I'll give you the respect and the honor of nations. But it wasn't good enough for them. They couldn't retain that humility that would have allowed them to show clemency towards other peoples. Instead, they bastardized the whole thing and chose to believe that God chose them because they were special, and it didn't matter what they did. And so even if he annulled their covenant and took them out of their promised land, still it was going to come back to them someday because God still loved them no matter what. And that's the whole message.
Now that brings me to another point I wanted to raise with you, and that was the introduction of Satan, which is a very Greek idea. Now you're saying the crux of the Kabbalistic religion is the worship of Satan, but Satan doesn't appear much in the Old Testament. You have it in the story of the Garden of Eden and the fall of Adam through the temptation of Eve. But I assume you find it a great deal in the Quran. And I'm wondering, how does Satan enter into Christianity? How does Satan enter into the Quran? And what was the role of the Greeks in that?
I don't know. I believe that... I don't think it was a Greek idea originally. I'm sure it was... it would have had to have existed. It did exist before the Jewish people because the knowledge has been there for a long time. There's a very interesting article by Peter Goodgame online about the Giza Pyramid mystery, but he also goes into this myth, ancient myth of a usurper god. And it's very interesting because this usurper god is the origin of the dying god myth. And this is only Luciferian, because throughout most of these cultures in the Middle East, you had this usurper god who eventually came to be worshipped. And he came to be worshipped as a personification of the sun and as being a god who dies and resurrects. And it was this god that was assimilated to Judaism and called Kabbalah after the 6th century BC.
Now, does this relate to the host of heaven and the worship of the stars that's mentioned throughout the Old Testament? Is that where Satan enters into?
Presumably, yeah. Well, host of heaven, that's astrology that's being imposed on the Bible, which is very interesting because that's, a lot of that's, if you look at the synagogues of the early 1st centuries AD, they most of them featured zodiac and God in his chariot pulled by four horses. This is Helios, of course, too, the god of the Greek god of the sun.
It was also Roman emperor worship. You find images of the worship of Caligula and others on Jupiter.
It's all Babylonian. The idea of this god pulled in a chariot, that's Marduk. That's a Babylonian god. And that's just the way that he infiltrated into Greek culture and then, either through or from Greek Jewish tradition. But that's why it's referred to in the right back in the beginning. And that's why, again, with Merkaba mysticism, it's called the ascension to the chariot. It's called chariot. Merkaba means chariot, so chariot mysticism.
Now,
because of identifying God as on his chariot.
In your interview with Henry Markov, and this will be the last subject while I've got you, I want to get your definition of this. You identified the Lurian Kabbalah as proposing a system whereby God created man. Man is now trying to use God created man as a means of knowing himself. As Kant said, man is where the universe has opened its eyes, and of analyzing himself. Can you explain your view of the Lurian Kabbalah?
Supposed to be, well, according to Luria, God, man is an other of God. So it's like God created another piece of himself. I hate saying things like that because it makes me feel. But that's because it's so ridiculous. Or so, anyway.
Do you see that as pantheistic, or do you see that as God splitting himself and creating opposing forces? In terms of the way Luria.
No. It's just the purpose. It's just the way. It's just it's the convoluted rationalization to justify, man claiming himself to be God.
And man is in a universe which is in a state of disorder because Gentiles exist, and that in order to restore order to the universe, the Gentiles have to either be subverted or completely annihilated. Is that the message of the Kabbalah?
Yeah. Well, ultimately, the great end is that it's I don't know which interpretation you read, but ultimately it's that the Jews will rule the world, and the Gentiles will be subjugated or eliminated. And you know, only Gentiles don't go to heaven, because when according to Kabbalah, when God says that He created man, it means that He created Jews. That Gentiles are not included in that category, in that species. That we are actually beasts like any other. And I think it was Lurie himself who said that the difference between a Jew and a Gentile is 1,000 times greater than the difference between a man and a cow.
Well, there have been Hasidic rabbis who have said the same. I wasn't aware that Luria had said that, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit. A lot of people believe that the Hasidic faith stemmed from Jacob Frank, and that the millions of his followers who mysteriously disappeared became Hasidim.
Right. Interesting.
But I want to get at the idea, the distinction in their viewpoint between what Jews are and what Gentiles are, in terms of the divine seed, in terms of the infusion of satanic seed into the human race, in terms of why do they feel at war with the Gentiles, and why do they feel that they have to overthrow the Gentiles, whereas Christianity and Islam are trying to proselytize to all people and create converts of all people. Judaism views itself as at war with the human race.
I don't know, but I think patriotism is just the ultimate vanity. You know, it's the first. I mean, how do you?
Well, I don't mean the psychological roots of it, although that's very interesting. I mean the religious roots. They see themselves as divine. And in your interview, you said that this juxtaposition of God to man can be won by man, and then man becomes God. Ultimately, the Messiah of the Jews is God Himself.
Right. Right.
What happens to God when this new order, and we could call it that, the new order that happens in the Messianic age, what happens to God when the descendant of Jacob Frank takes over the world?
Well, I guess that's it. I mean, then the order in the universe is fixed. Then God and man are one again. Something like that.
Well, I look at it in terms of Plato. You would have man ascending into the ideal form.
Okay, yeah, but I don't think that those things are much of an issue. I think the ultimate issue is just to fulfill prophecy in their interpretation of it, and the key to that is really just establishing themselves as rulers of the earth. So beyond that, there may be some philosophical underpinnings, but that's really the point.
I agree with you completely, but I think people, you expressed it so well, people would find fascinating how you describe this antagonism that Luria creates between the divine Jews and God Himself, and how they view themselves, and how this came about. If you could give a description of that, I would be most grateful.
You got me. Can you remind me?
Well, what I can do is direct people again to the interview which I posted on my blog with Henry Markov. Uh-huh. And they'll find that of special interest. And I want to thank you. Can you give your website and information about your books and how people can obtain your books?
I've got two books. The first one's called The Dying God, The Hidden History of Western Civilization. That's mostly what we talked about today. And that's at www.thedyinggod.com. My recent book is called Terrorism and the Illuminati. That looks at the emergence of the 12 tribes, of the lost tribes, and their entry into the formulation of the occult races, that the families, the dynasties that first created Mithraism, and then on to the Templars and Freemasons, and finally some of the occult connections that we talked about between with Islamic terrorist groups. And the website for that is www.terrorism-illuminati.com.
Wonderful. One final thing. Mithra is associated with a bull, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And we have, at the time of Moses and Aaron, the worship of the golden calf.
Yeah.
You maintain that worship continues and is the fundamental nature of Judaism at the higher echelons,
yes,
among the Kabbalists.
Yeah.
Do you believe that Solomon's temple was a temple of the worship of the golden calf? Because that's what I believe. I believe the ark actually contained the golden calf, and that the mercy seat was a place that they would place the golden calf upon to worship. And that is why they would allow no one in to see what was going on there.
Well, the Tavola has, the Quran has one of the most important pieces of evidence that I have found that basically unraveled the whole mystery for me. And it says very clearly that that in Babylon there was a section of the Jews who apostatized, and they learned magic, which they claim came from Solomon, but it didn't come from Solomon because Solomon was a just prophet. Actually, from demons. And
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? You've been cutting out consistently, but mostly I could follow what you were saying. So would you? Think you said that it came from demons. Which came from demons?
Well, see, in Islam, the devil is just he belongs to a race or a species of beings called jinn. We know the jinn in Western culture as genie, and so there's humans and there's jinn, and a jinn is made up of some kind of other composition than matter. And what happened is that the devil, when God created man, he was asked to honor a man, but he refused to because he was made of some kind of superior nature. So, but the devil is only one of this species, and there's, I don't know how what their number is, but there's all kinds of them, and people know them as ghosts or goblins and, you know, spirits or even ETs and things like that, but they're just another being that exists on this planet, and or wherever else they exist.
And the magic of Babylon came from these creatures and not from Solomon.
Well, it says, I think it says specifically it calls them Satans. So it means to some extent that they were Luciferian. They were either Luciferians or, you know, some early version of Illuminati or something like that.
And that this is the source of all the problems in the world.
Yes.
And that this is the religion of the ruling elite.
Yes.
And that the Jews will ultimately adopt this, restore themselves to Palestine, and become rulers of the world, and that their leader will be seen as God, will be worshipped by the Jews as God. So it matches exactly what Revelation anticipates.
Exactly.
So the Christians and Muslims should not be at one another's throat. They should be allies against this evil force.
Absolutely.
Well, again...
And Jews.
And all humanity. All humanity.
All the true Jews out there as well, too.
Absolutely. All of humanity. Jews.
And all men, exactly. You know, and the Quran has a verse that says something to the effect that, you know, the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims, and the Sabians. Then it says very clearly, and any who believe in God in the day of judgment and who do good will have their just reward.
What do you think will be the reaction of Islam if the crazies succeed in their plan to destroy Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock and build a Temple of Solomon on the site? And do you believe that that is the site of the Temple of Solomon?
Yes. And the problem is that there, you know, Islam, in 1924, when the Ottoman Empire was destroyed, that was the end of 1,300 years of Islamic civilization. And throughout that period, there was always some degree of consolidated authority. In our century, it's the first time in Islamic history when there is not. And so, you know, I compare it to an anthill. We used to live in an anthill, and now the anthill is broken, so all the ants are scattering. And that pretty much is the state of the Islamic world right now. So for anyone who perceives that there might be some kind of unified voice or whatever, it's an illusion that's propped up by CNN and has no semblance of the truth. And the so-called fundamentalists are really a tiny little narrow fringe, and that comes from the CIA anyway. So the problem is that the Islamic world is in no state to be able to respond in any meaningful way to that kind of attack. And I think if there was one, it would be it would be artificially brought about?
That's what I anticipate, is that it'll instigate revolutions instead of a unification.
Right.
People, Muslims in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, especially the Arab nations, will feel betrayed by their leadership and will attack their leadership and further weaken themselves.
Yeah. And it's just to see if that's actually going to be a sincere Muslim movement or if it's going to be an instigated one.
And I'm sure, as you say, the Freemasonry has so thoroughly infiltrated all those nations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the so-called fundamentalist movements.
Well, again, I thank you very much for speaking with me. I think it was a wonderful conversation. I've ordered your books, and perhaps after I've read your books, I could have you on again. And I suspect some of my readers will have questions for me and ask for clarifications on certain issues. So perhaps we can have another conversation in the future.
That'd be great. It's been great talking to you, Mr. Ray. Thanks for all the awesome questions.
Can you give your website one more time, and then we'll close it?
Yeah, two, thedyinggod.com and terrorism-illuminati.com.
Thank you again, and
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.